Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 8 in our current series, The State versus Greg Lance. That episode is called Witnesses for the Prosecution. And if you haven't heard the episode yet, go back and listen and then come back and listen to this addendum. We will be here. I promise. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and one of the audio editors for Undisclosed. And with me today is Rabia Chaudhry. She's the New York Times best-selling author of Anon Story and lead reporter on this series, and overall badass. Hello, Rabia. How are you?
I'm okay, Rebecca. How are you?
Good, good. It's okay. Not all of us can be badass every minute of the day, Rabia, but, you know.
I think I'm defeated by technology. What can I say?
Also with us is Colin Miller. He's Associate Dean and Professor at the Law School at the University of South Carolina. That's the University of South Carolina School of Law, by the way. He's also my favorite legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm pretty good. And our special guest this week, one of the very best podcast people I know, and I really mean it, Amber Hunt. She's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and she's host of the podcasts Accused and Aftermath. Hello again, Amber.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Well, before we get into our conversation, I'm just going to do a quick synopsis of episode 8, Witnesses for the Prosecution. The episode examines the evidence that was put on by the state in Greg Lance's trial, the physical evidence and witnesses that convinced a jury of his guilt. The physical evidence the state presented in the case consisted of the flashlight and the cord attached to the gun, the gas on his shoes and or socks, and singed hairs from Greg's hand. Other physical evidence that also existed but was never presented was the inconclusive GSR test, that's gunshot residue test. The storage unit never figured in any real way in the state's narrative, but they still put on the storage unit clerk to testify about it, perhaps just to create some additional suspicion. The state presented 4 witnesses who all corroborated each other's testimony to some extent: Eric Tanner, Keith Herbstreit, Rocky Harmon, and Mike Snow. They were all men who personally knew Greg and testified that he expressed a desire to kill the Kolesnikows, tried to solicit someone to do it, and was seeking a stolen gun. The prosecution also put on 3 other witnesses who didn't really know Greg, to testify that he was seen on the Heron farm on both the day the neighbors heard gunshots and also the day the neighbors said someone had a burn pile going. These 3 witnesses not only testified to just seeing Greg there, but to seeing him do exactly what the state alleged. Jerry Gardner said he saw Greg with a gun and that Greg told him he was target practicing. And Brian Brinker and Marlon Ray, the guys looking to buy rabbits from Joe Brown, both testified they saw Greg burning dresser drawers. From a distance, it seems like so many witnesses stating the same or similar thing couldn't be a coincidence, which is what the state argued. And it worked, because the jury convicted Greg after deliberating for just 5 hours. Now, Amber, I know you've been listening to the podcast because I've seen you tweet about it. And before we dig into what happened this week, I'm wondering if you have any questions about anything you heard prior to this week that you might want to ask Rabia or Colin about real quick.
I'm not totally clear on... Their theory is that he killed them to wipe out his debt.
Yeah, that's the state's theory, that he was trying to stop his property from being taken back.
So I'm a little confused, because didn't he filed for bankruptcy, though, right?
He did. Yeah, that is correct.
Okay, so yes. I'm supposed to be confused.
Yes.
Okay.
I think you're supposed to be confused, because the bankruptcy stuff doesn't really bear out. Like, he's not released from that obligation just because they died. Like, that's accurate.
Okay.
Okay, now that's cleared up.
That's what was throwing me. Yep. Okay.
Well, the state opens the trial by acknowledging that their case is largely circumstantial, but simultaneously, they argue the green cord and the gas on Greg's shoes, the reports about the gas, are hard scientific evidence. Colin, can you just address that, the way that they approach this, by really like hammering home that circumstantial stuff, but then really arguing evidentiary science in their closing in particular?
Yeah, so this is a question that I get asked a lot, and it's the dichotomy between circumstantial and direct evidence. So direct evidence is evidence that by itself proves one or more of the elements of a crime. So an eyewitness, a video recording of someone committing a crime, a confession by a defendant would all be direct evidence because by itself it would prove the defendant's guilt. Circumstantial evidence is evidence that by itself does not prove one or more of the elements of a crime, but when combined with other circumstantial or direct evidence, it can eventually build up and lead to the defendant's guilt. And so, you know, some things that are pretty strong forensic scientific evidence can be circumstantial. You can have fingerprints or blood that matches the DNA of the defendant found at the crime scene. And that's still circumstantial because it doesn't prove that they actually committed the crime. It just proves they were at the crime scene at some point in time. And so what the state in the Greg Lantz case is trying to do is to say, we have some of this forensic evidence here, and our argument to the jury is that this is strong, powerful evidence, something akin to fingerprint evidence. And of course, the defense, and I think we've been arguing in the podcast as well, would say this is a lot weaker and a lot more tenuous than a lot of better forensic evidence you might see in other cases.
Amber, do you ever wish, like as a journalist, that you could just sit in a courtroom and just like stand up and rebut and say, you know, I don't think that word means what you think it means. The scientific facts, the beyond a reasonable doubt, when we literally just heard the opposite from these experts on the stand.
Yeah, I actually, I did start to yell at the podcast this morning because it drives me nuts that the opening and the closing statements can pretty much be entirely fiction and that has no bearing on anything. So you can call something a smoking gun when it's clearly not anything close to that, so long as it's in that beginning and that ending. So yeah, no, that drives me nuts. And I've seen it in some of the cases we've done too, where you're just like, but that's not what was said. And that's, yeah, it's frustrating.
So I want to just ask about the flashlight, Rabia. Eric Tanner's earlier description, because he was the one who was asked about the size of the batteries that went in the flashlight, right?
Yep, that's right.
Like how wide is the flashlight? Mm-hmm. And so he clearly describes one in an earlier statement that's like your standard like Maglite sized fat, you know, right, Energizer or whatever flashlight. But that in no way correlates with the actual flashlight that she's shown a photo of on the stand, which is like a skinny little tubular flashlight and that he identifies as being Greg's, right?
Right. That's right. I mean, you know, it's not uncommon in these kinds of cases to see witness statements change over time. And it's interesting, like as I, you know, going through, I have different kinds of copies of the transcripts and there are some that are like printed out and Greg himself has taken notes all over it. And he's always marking, you know, because he's keeping track. He's like, that's not what he said before. That's not what he said before. That's not. And it's just not uncommon. And I think what happens, I mean, look, this, as far as I'm concerned, as far as undisclosed is concerned, is a wrongful conviction. So in that case, you have to figure out like what happened with the witnesses that they went from basically not identifying these things, connecting them to Greg, to then doing that. I mean, something happened in those interim, you know, however long it was, 18 months between the arrest and the trial, or the 2 years between the murders and the trial. And that's something we're going to unpack actually in next week's episode, is what's going on here. But it happens. We've seen in almost every case that we've looked at is like, you know, witness statements change. And, you know, when Laura Nyreiter was on, I think it was our second or third addendum, she said one of the things she always looks at is she tries to graph out like how a witness statement, what is in a witness statement over time, and compare it to what the police know at the time, type of thing, to see if there's any correlation there between the changes.
Now, and Colin, we always see this on procedurals on TV. When a witness says one thing to police and then a different thing in the courtroom, we always see like the big objection and they didn't you, sir, earlier tell police XYZ. Is that just fiction? Like, are defense attorneys not actually paying that close attention as we are as TV viewers of episodes of Law and Order?
Well, actually, I was just teaching hearsay to my students in evidence class this morning, and you know, you vary in terms of how good defense counsel is. Sometimes they're often on autopilot and they're not paying attention. But yeah, we have this rule, Federal Rule of Evidence 613, and their state counterparts, and they say if there are prior inconsistent statements by a witness, you're absolutely permitted to point those out and rigorously cross-examine the witness about those. And so certainly you should have, as an attorney, those prior statements. You should pay attention for any changes in that testimony at trial, and you should hammer home when those changes are significant. And to the point that Robbie was just making, it is interesting to track what police knew when, because you can often see how this statement was crafted in a way to fit the state's theory at trial when it initially started out matching the evidence maybe they had at first that was lacking certain details that came more visible later. And so, yeah, this can be done. It should be done. It often is done, but too often it's not done. And the defense doesn't sort of put the prosecution witnesses through their paces.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Amber, have you ever reported on a case like this where, you know, things were said in court that weren't said before? Or do you just like track cases like this and, like me, find yourself wondering why? Like, why is it Greg who's making the notes and pointing this out? Like, why don't his lawyers like completely impeach these people?
Well, it certainly speaks to, you know, who cares about the case the most. Actually, the case I'm looking at right now, what I happen to notice that there's an initial investigation, and then there are trials afterward. They're not murder trials, but they're related trials afterward. And the testimony given in those later trials don't remotely match what was said initially. And you're looking at it and you're like, well, why didn't anybody push back on that? But the fact is that the detectives and the lawyers in the case just weren't as well versed. I mean, some of this is benefit of hindsight. I've got all of this stuff. I'm looking at it. It's on my desk right now, you know. But you kind of assume when you're thinking about a case, especially when somebody's life is on the line, you assume that people are as well versed as possible. And it's just not true a lot of the time.
So I will say this with Eric Tanner, there were a number of, this wasn't the only inconsistency in his statements. And part of the problem is we have thousands of documents. For some reason, we are missing the full statement that he gave, the first one on the day of the murders. And then the second one he gave about a month and a half later, or almost 2 months later. We only have like a part of that. And the only reason we have a part of that is because it was attached as an exhibit to an appeal later. I think it was an appeal or maybe it was a motion. But, you know, we don't even have the full statements. But at trial, there are a couple of other instances of inconsistencies that Greg's defense counsel does bring up, saying that previously said one of them is about the time that he saw Greg that night at the house. He at one point had said 12:30, then he said 1:30 a.m. Then he went back. I think at trial he went back to 12:30, so they tried to corner him on that. Another time was whether or not he had actually been on the Heron farm before. On the stand, he said no, but in a previous statement, he actually had told Krofsick that he had been at the Heron farm once before. So those are the two things. But I mean, this piece of evidence, I think was so important that this was something that they actually didn't catch. They did not point this inconsistency out. And that was like a big failure on their part.
You're talking about the flashlight, right?
Yeah, the flashlight. I thought that was like a big one.
Yeah. No, it is a big one. And it's, you know, if a flashlight is found with a murder weapon and someone says, yeah, that flashlight belongs to Amber.
Right.
Like, clearly that points more toward Amber being the owner of the murder weapon.
Yeah.
Are you going to get into, you talked about how you're going to unpack in a future episode or set of episodes that the changing statements over time or why it is that these guys may have testified the way they did. I'm dying to know about these hitman claims. Like that is that's the most damning thing, I think. Well,
yeah.
Even beyond the flashlight, beyond everything. Are you going to get into reasons why those claims were made or how that happened?
Oh, absolutely. On Monday's episode.
Oh, can't wait. Okay. Next question.
Yeah, I'm excited about that too, because that's the one thing where you're like, okay, everything's pretty weak, but why would somebody say this? So
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a specific thing to claim, right? Like not just that he kind of vaguely talked about wanting these people dead, but that he came to me with an amount of money. And it's a very specific claim. So I am curious to know how that happened or what the backstory was. So I'm looking forward to hearing it. Moving on to the cord. While the state argued that the green cord was the most conclusive evidence tying Greg to the crime, the lab results actually found that the cord on his property didn't even match the murder weapon cord. Rabia, is there a way that you can just remind us of that disparity? Because it was kind of complicated in the podcast, all these different tests that were done, but just like baseline it. Yeah.
So there were a number of pieces of cord that were submitted to the lab to compare against the cord that was attached to the gun. Two of those pieces of cord came from Greg's property, like his actual property, this tree in his yard. And there was cord in his truck that was tied to this tarp. Then there's two other pieces of cord that were found off of his property, but that the neighbor said they got from his property. One of them is like this bow. This 10-year-old kid had fashioned some cord into a bow, and they asked him, where did this green cord come from? He said, I got it from my neighbor's yard, Greg's yard. And then just some loose cord that was also laying, I think, in the same neighbor's yard. So when they match these, so these are four samples that they're going to match against the murder weapon cord. The two samples that were found off of his yard were consistent with a murder weapon cord in terms of color and diameter and just kind of a general comparison. They're all nylon. But the two pieces of cord that were actually found on his yard, and most importantly, the one found in the tree, because the story about the cord in the tree comes directly from Keith, who is a state's witness. And Keith says, I know that's his cord because I strung it up with fireworks, threw it up in his tree, and the cord that you've collected from the tree is that leftover cord. And that's how not only he identifies it in two ways. First, by saying he's the one who put it in that tree. But second, also he's saying the fireworks themselves had left these black marks because the cord on the murder weapon had these black marks like every couple of inches for the entire length of it. So he said that, oh yeah, that happened because of the fireworks I had attached that cord. The problem is, the cord that they collected from Greg's house, from that tree and his car, didn't have any of the burn marks and also was actually inconsistent in color and diameter. So that's right. The lab found
different
that.
Cord.
It's a different cord.
Yeah.
So there you go. I don't know if I made it more complicated or less. But
no,
anyway.
I mean, I think it made it very, very simple. So like the cord that was actually at his house, at Greg's house, did not match the cord that was next to the murder weapon. It just didn't.
It didn't.
But the
that
cord
was
that was found in adjacent properties did somewhat.
Right.
They didn't match scientifically, but like in terms of definitely being from the same batch or whatever, but they were the same general kind. That's right?
That is correct. And this was evidence that was never presented to the jury.
Amber, before I get your reaction to that, can I first get your reaction to the idea that tying fireworks to a cord and throwing them in up into a tree makes it somehow more fun?
I would have to dispute that. That does not sound like a good idea, and kids, don't try that at home.
Just exactly.
Yeah.
I hate to break this to you, Rebecca, but I have extensive video footage of that. Of that actual scene being reenacted. We're going to hear from some of it next
really?
Week. Yeah. And it actually looks like fun.
Wow.
I'm sorry, but it kind of does look like fun.
Wow.
Okay. Amber, what do you think of this idea that the state at trial used the word scientific when describing this match between the cord found at the suspect's house and the cord found on the murder weapon when we in fact know that it did not match? Thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the part where I got a little upset with my phone. Like, what? Because, I mean, just using the term scientific in your closing argument doesn't make it so, but it does impart to the jury that, you know, this person who has authority believes that the tests back him up on this, and the fact is the tests don't back him up on it, and what's most infuriating is that the defense lawyer didn't seem to notice that they didn't match up. And you're like, you know, that's pretty important when the the prosecutor is saying the one thing that he wishes he had done differently was, you know, use a different cord. Well, it didn't match. So that's not conclusive.
But the crazy thing is this, though.
It's kind of the opposite.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is, though, Little John, when she testified, she also didn't say, she actually never said conclusively. She said that they're all consistent in color, but she's like, I still can't say that they definitely came from the same source. So even though her testimony wasn't accurate as compared to the lab results, even her testimony did not conclusively say, like, it wasn't scientific. There was no scientific match, even given what was actually presented to the jury.
But she didn't present it that way, right? Little John is her name, right?
She did. She said that they are consistent in... the cords are all consistent, you know, and
right,
when she was
right.
challenged, she said that, well, they're consistent, but it doesn't exclude the possibility that they came from different sources. Like, you can have
and
three
that they're common and
yeah.
So Robbie, when you say the neighbor kid made a bow, do you mean like a bow on a gift or a bow, like a bow and arrow?
Oh, sorry. Oh, is that not clear? It's a bow and an arrow.
No,
it was like tied
I was just
to a,
curious.
It was tied to a stick.
Tied to a stick.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering. Okay. Just checking.
Can I ask a question about Little John? Has her testimony in other cases ever come into question? Because it seems like that's a pretty big turnaround from her original statement that it was a very common cord, and then on trial saying, well, I would have no way of knowing that.
Yeah, and by the way, they didn't impeach that either. I mean, the defense counsel had their defense investigators' reports, but they didn't impeach her saying that either. I actually don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It's really hard because, I mean, like, it's been hard to find, with the exception of one of the experts that testified, and we're going to be getting into him in a couple of weeks because he's kind of important. The other ones, I haven't found anything like publicly available that show that in this case or that case there was any problematic testimony. So it's possible there's something there, but I haven't been able to find it from public sources.
So he did have defense investigators with this defense in this trial. That's what I was curious about.
Yeah, we've talked about it many times. Defense investigator Ronald Lax. Ronald Lax is the one who met with that Debbie, and you know that's the defense investigator.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just double checking only because. There is, you know, obviously defense resources vary, you know, depending on who your lawyer is.
Yeah, he was lucky enough.
Or appointed.
Yeah, he was lucky enough that when he was he was able to get a designated indigent, they did designate some funds. And that's what Greg was frustrated, because the court designated funds for an investigator, but also for the defense to hire their own experts. And they didn't.
Hmm. Well, okay. That's awesome, I guess. Not. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the other evidence, the so-called scientific evidence. The gas evidence, the shoe and sock, which apparently were contaminated because they were put in the same bag together or something. And this whole debate over the alleged singed hair on Greg's hand. Of course, people listening to the podcast will remember that the police at one point shaved Greg's hand to collect some hairs, and that he was cool with that because as far as he was concerned, it would help exonerate him. Colin, can you talk about those two pieces of evidence and their strength or lack thereof?
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of the gas and the toluene, as we kind of mentioned on the episode, there's been a ton of cases where this has come up, and it was used in the glue and shoes and sneakers. And so for that to come back positive for the toluene, that's not too strong in terms of implicating him. And, you know, obviously they're trying to say this is gas that he was used to start this fire, and that wouldn't be too strong. In terms of the singed hairs, I looked this up when we were preparing the episode. And, you know, this has come up a decent amount in arson cases, but what you typically see are cases where people like singed all the hair off of their arms or their face, and there were other signs that they had been in close proximity to a fire. I haven't seen a single case out of sort of dozens of other cases where it was just a few hairs they're saying that were singed on an arm or a hand. And, you know, I don't know. We haven't spoken to an arson expert or a fire expert on this, but I would imagine that with the nature of the fire that was involved in this case, if he were the person to have started it, you would have seen many more singed hairs than the few that they found here. But again, I can't say that myself, but it seems a little bit questionable, the theory being that he just burned a few hairs on his hand if he in fact started this pretty wide-ranging fire.
Yeah. Robbie, I'm curious, what is Greg's response to this witness that says that he saw Greg at the Heron Farm that same day that everybody else apparently was trying to place him there, burning dresser drawers? Like, that was the first time I heard that story. Does Greg have a response to that claim?
Yeah, he says it's a lie.
That it just didn't happen. He just wasn't there, was not burning dresser drawers.
Yeah, he's like, it's absolutely, none of this happened. In fact, Greg says, since the time he was shot, remember early on, one of the early episodes, we talked about how Keith shot him?
Accidentally
when they were out shooting there. And that was like in March or April of that year. Like, he had not returned to the Heron Farm since.
So it was Brinker and that guy Marlon Ray who were looking to buy a rabbit or rabbits from Joe Brown. I'm dying to know, by the way, pets or meat. I'm dying to know the answer to that. I think I do know, but I'm curious anyway. They're the ones who testified they saw Greg burning those dresser drawers, right? I'm right about remembering that, right?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Greg says it just didn't happen.
Yeah, and this is supposed to be on the day that, remember the other neighbors, and this is like late in August, like so weeks, when the police are closing in on the Heron Farm, they want to do the search, and the neighbors have seen this smoke come up. And so that's how the state is connecting it, that he was seen, you know, because the problem is the neighbors, and I we talked about how earlier, there's no way the neighbors could have seen some of what they said they saw anyways. But also none of the neighbors could identify Greg. They're like, we didn't see anybody. We just saw smoke. They saw nothing except one woman said, Roberta Powell, the neighbor said that she thought she saw a blue and white truck. Nobody else could see anything except for they saw smoke. So now the state's like, well, wait a minute, somebody was there and they actually saw the source of that smoke. And that was this dark complected Mexican looking guy, which I don't know to what extent that helps the state, but that's what Brinker and Ray said, that they went out there, but they pinned Greg to it. But I mean, it's weird. They described him one way, but then they pointed to him in the courtroom and said, yeah, that was the guy who was doing it.
I know. We should say, like, that whole Mexican looking guy was their words, not your guys' words.
Exactly. Yeah. That was their words.
Does Greg in any way resemble what they described the person looking like that they saw? I haven't seen a picture of Greg. So does he look like a dark skinned, dark complected, dark haired person?
He's got dark hair, but he looks pretty pale to me. I don't know.
There's a line in Flight of the Conchords where this woman is hoping that another woman looks like her, and she goes, she looks like me, right? And the joke is, the guy says, well, she has eyes. Okay.
Yeah.
I looked him up. He doesn't look like that.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure exactly what quote unquote Mexican looking is. I mean, I'm assuming it's, you know, darker
olive complexion,
and all
that,
but
I don't think anybody would identify him as looking Latino. I don't think anybody would. And one of our title images, I can't remember which episode it was, one of the title images does have a picture of him. I think it was episode 7's title image actually has a picture of Greg and Becky and their newborn daughter, so you can actually see what it looks like.
That's right. Go to the website, everyone. Yeah. Check it out. Check out all the supplemental stuff that's going with this podcast.
If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
I'm really curious about this Jerry Gardner guy and his friends. Apparently, he is the reason why Judy Wells saw a man and a couple of drunk women at the Heron Farm that day that she says she saw them. Apparently, it was Jerry Gardner, right?
Yeah, so that story that Judy had where she drove past the farm and she saw, as she was heading out to get that newspaper right before she made the call to the police, was actually true. I mean, she had seen a couple of women drunk and falling over themselves, and she saw this car, a brown looking car with a vinyl top, which is exactly the kind of car that Jerry Gardner owned. And the trunk was open. He was standing by it. I mean, she only went past them very briefly. Apparently, maybe there was a second. There was a second man with him, but I think he might have stayed in the car because Gardner said they were only there for a few minutes so the ladies could, you know, relieve themselves. That actually did happen. And what I have not been able to figure out is how the state figured out that that was Jerry Gardner. Like, I've not found anything in the investigative files to show, like, how they made that connection that, oh, that's who that is. But they did figure it out, and but they didn't let that go to waste. They're like, oh, okay, so it was definitely him, but now what? Like, how can he be useful to us as a witness? And he became useful to them as a witness because he said, oh, yeah, we were there, but so was Greg.
And Greg also says that he did not see Jerry Gardner there, right? Like, he wasn't there.
Greg's like, I haven't been there in, like, 8 months. Yeah.
All right, so I want to ask a question. I'm going to ask it to Amber because you're also a listener like me. Do you buy this idea that Gardner and his friends were renting a cabin? And we know they did rent a cabin because there's paperwork to back it up. But that they went by a farmhouse that they knew was empty, where nobody was living, in order to use the bathroom. Do you buy that?
I would have a hard time with that if this were one of my cases. Yes, that would be one of the things I pursued because that...
Because you know what else has bathrooms? Gas stations and diners and all the businesses you will pass as you're driving to wherever it is you're going.
And Jerry's own house, because Jerry didn't live far from there, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that there's anything nefarious going on, like it was their staging area to commit a double homicide and arson. What I'm saying is that, and this is totally speculation on my part, it sounds like they were just fooling around and, like, wanted to go to an abandoned farm to, like, have some fun or something. But that later, that story does not sound great. So this bathroom story just seems like a thinly veiled way to, like, put yourself there for a respectable reason. That was my very strong impression when I heard that version of events. Robbie, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, so here's a gross little side story. I've heard this from a number of different sources. I mean, like in the documents and stuff, where apparently, I don't know if it was the shed or I don't know what, there's a number of little outhouses on that property, but there's some, one of those little places had like a dirty old mattress on it and guys would take girls back there. Apparently one time when Eric Tanner had given a previous statement to Agent Kropstick saying that, yeah, we had been to the Heron Farm once, he said what happened was him and Keith were out driving and Keith pulled over and also so Eric could take a leak at the farm. And Keith pointed out some place at the back of the farm saying, oh, there's a love shack back there and it's a great place to take a date, which is so gross. Mm. So now I'm not saying that's what was happening because it would have been weird because Gardner's date, his girlfriend or whoever was with him that day, you know, the other couple was her brother and his wife. So I doubt if they were there out fooling around together, but I don't know. I don't know why they were out there, but, you know, here's the thing though, Gardner, and Heron went way back. They went back to childhood. They've known each other since childhood. So he was out there all the time.
Hmm. I'm still waiting for the gross part of that story, by the way.
the love shack with the
gross. Yeah.
With the dirty.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking about like the CSI scene you'd get with like the light and like all of the stains.
Stop.
So it's gross, but you're right. It is gross.
It's gross.
It sounds like, I mean, what it actually sounds like is Mike Heron owns this piece of property. He's got a bunch of dude friends who have come over there to practice shooting and have fires and hang out. And it continues to be a hangout / gathering spot, even though he's in California. That's what it sounds like to me. It doesn't sound like there are crimes being committed. It just sounds like people are taking advantage of the fact that they know Mike's not there.
Right.
And they're hanging out at his place.
Yeah.
Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
All right. Well, ironically, the suspicious people that Judy Wells saw on August 2nd turns out to be Jerry Gardner and his crew. They say they were only there 5 minutes, allegedly ran into Greg. And then a couple days later, the Brinker and Ray say they also ran into Greg, as we mentioned. Colin, is Greg just the unluckiest murderer ever? Or does this all of this seem like a bit unlikely? I'm curious to know your thoughts.
Well, you know, I mean, we've seen this pattern recur so many times in the different cases we've handled over the years. I mean, it goes all the way back to the Adnan Syed case with Jay Wilds and all these different competing timelines. But we've seen so many of these cases. I mean, Terrence Lewis, Willie Viesti, Chester Holman. We have these various conflicting witnesses and timelines, and that, among other evidence, calls into question these convictions. And so, you know, there's always this question out there of like, oh, you know, going back to Sirianni on the Adnan Syed case, is he the unluckiest person ever? And you start to comb through these examples of wrongful convictions, some of which we've covered, and you can go to the National Registry of Exonerations, and they all have these situations where you're just, oh my God, this person is so unlucky. How could all these things come together where an innocent person is being convicted? And so, you know, looking at everything here in this case, I can A, both see how he was eventually convicted in this case, but B, see all types of things that should have been raised and weren't raised, and inconsistencies and problems with the evidence that cause all sorts of doubt that the jurors just never heard.
Amber, don't you feel like you could say that with anybody who's convicted of a crime? Like, this is the unluckiest person in the world because X, Y, Z, and P, D, Q all pointed to this person committing this crime. I mean, doesn't that seem like a ridiculous, false, rhetorical argument?
I'm thinking. sometimes when I see a conviction, there's a lot pointing, and it's not luck, it's stupidity, you know? So sometimes I think people are idiots, but I mean, all the stars kind of have to, the planets need to align for you to get away with something like this. So, I mean, I guess you're automatically like unlucky if you get caught and you have half a brain.
Hmm. I think that, to me, of course, what it makes me always think about is the episode of Serial where Dana Chivas talks about Adnan being unlucky, and she sort of points to that as her leaning toward his guilt. And it felt so, honestly, just like rhetorically false to me, because of course somebody is going to look unlucky if there's a story that has been, you know, bolstered by an investigation that sort of puts together tenuous threads. Of course they're going to put together the threads in such a way that it makes it seem like, okay, this person's either guilty or they're the unluckiest person in the world. I have something about it that really bothers me. It's like it shouldn't be enough, especially when there are so many factors at play, like sandwiching these weird statements together of people running into Greg, and then is he the unluckiest person in the world because there was a piece of green cord in his tree? No, he means he had a piece of green cord in his tree. It doesn't mean he's an unlucky murderer. You know what I mean?
I mean, you know, I think in this case, like, the state is like, you know, the state says over and over, they use the word coincidence over and over. It can't be a coincidence. Can't be a coincidence. And we're going to talk about whether or not it can be a coincidence in next week's episode. But like, let's say Greg actually committed these murders, right? I mean, how unlucky would you have to be? Is like every time you're like planning for the murder or something, like you just pop into this farm and like people pop by and see you there during this time, because, you know, on top of which, you know, you've got, let's say Greg's out there, or any murderers out there target practicing, and a group of four people pull up, are you really going to walk up to them and with your gun slinged into your belt saying, yep, I'm just out here target practicing a few days before I kill my
victim? Practicing for a murder.
Just practicing for a murder. And, you know, also telling Keith, you know, because Keith testified, yep, Greg said, I'm going to go out to the Heron Farm today and practice for some murder. Maybe there are criminals stupid enough to do that. But I think most people, if they're not wanting to get caught committing murder, wouldn't be so, hey, can you kill this person for me? Hey, can you kill this person for me? I'm going to go practice some target shooting. I don't know. It's kind of crazy to me. It's crazy what the state is trying to argue is crazy to me.
It is. And I just want to point out again, to me, as a listener, knowing all the evidence that the state has and looking at the stuff that I looked at, there really is nothing connecting the farm to the murder. So
right.
Greg says he wasn't there. He wasn't there. That's fine. But obviously, at some point, a decision was made that the farm was connected to the murder, because all of these threads, they connect Greg to the farm. Now, to remind our listeners, the farm is not the scene of the murder.
But the bullets. There are bullets,
where the murder
right?
happened.
There are the bullets. So we have to remember
there
that
are
too.
Bullets a lot of places.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there are.
And it's amazing to me. It reminds me a lot of, you know, it's like the Hayes car thing, right? It's like, you know, you have this. It doesn't actually complete the picture you want it to complete, because when you realize that a decision was made along the way that there is a story of the crime, it changes the lens through which you see these locations and these pieces of evidence. And to me, the farm is the most egregious example of that in almost any case you guys have ever covered. I'm like, I don't give a shit if someone thinks they saw Greg at the murder. I really don't. I don't understand why the jury would, because that's not the scene of the murder. Anyway, sorry to rant. I have a question about the trial. It was only 3 days long, but very long days and like into the weekend. How unusual is that? And, you know, that sort of super long day, what kind of impact can that have on a jury? What do you think, Colin?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something where it's the judge's discretion, and sometimes the judge will say, like, we're going 9 to 5, and, you know, that's all we're going to do. Whereas there are other cases where the judge really wants to wrap it up, and so they will have deliberations late into the night and even on the weekends. So, you know, this is something where we're actually having this discussion here at our law school, and other schools are having it as well. How long should a class session be? And there's a lot of research that shows if you're even going beyond an hour of a class session, that students' minds start to wander and they stop processing information. Yeah, I mean, you can only imagine with trials, if you're extending beyond an 8-hour day and the jurors are hearing this and it's, you know, they go late into the night, they start early the next day. You just have to imagine, and I don't know, there might be some research on this. I haven't looked into it too much, but with these really lengthy trials and not much of a way of a break for the jurors, that they're just not processing that information the same way they would if we have more breaks and we break up the trial more and allow them to sort of sit and process this information.
And jurors in some places, and I know it's different places, they're typically not allowed to take notes, right?
Correct. And that's something I've advocated for, is there are some jurisdictions that allow it. And I think when there's two things. A, are jurors allowed to take notes? And some jurisdictions say yes, others say absolutely not. You're not even allowed to have a pen and paper. And then some jurisdictions allow jurors to ask questions filtered by the judge, and other jurisdictions don't. And my argument has always been, if you allow them to take notes and ask questions, they're going to be more active participants and more engaged in the process. Whereas if they're just passive and sitting there, your mind is much more likely to wander and you're not as likely to be tuned in and paying attention to what's going on.
You know, it's hard on the jurors. It's also hard on the lawyers. I totally think, I mean, like, you know, the way that Marshall Judd opened his closing arguments was like, my teeth are like, everything is tired, you know, because it's like 8 or 9 p.m. at this point on Friday night after like 12 hour days continuously. And actually on Friday, they went longer than 12 hours. So I think it has an impact on the performance of attorneys to competently, you know, represent their clients as well. So I really haven't seen this in other trials, like, you know, go that long, but I guess it is something that happens. But the other thing I want to say about the note taking, if jurors were allowed to take notes, I mean, they might be able to catch the kinds of things that, for example, like when we talk about the Adnan's case, how many times like Jay and Jen say that, you know, oh, he was at our house, he was at the house till 3:45 p.m., which directly contradicts the 2:36 p.m. call, right? Like, so if somebody had taken notes on that, they would have caught that because the lawyer failed to point that out. And in this case, ironically, there's also a 2:36 p.m. call, which is kind of weird to me because it's the same exact call. But anyway, and that 2:36 p.m. call is really important because that means on this Sunday, August 2nd, you know, the phone call to the police, that is all from a police log. It came in at 2:36. Everything that Judy saw before on the farm, including Jerry and the other women and all that, had to happen before 2:36. Everything she saw happened before she made that call. But it couldn't, that means it was impossible for Greg to have been there because you have witnesses saying that at that exact time he was at this trailer park. The state's own witnesses put him there. So maybe a jury taking notes if counsel fails to point that kind of those little itty bitty details out. But it's an itty bitty detail, but it's a really important detail.
Yeah. Amber, do you have thoughts about whether jurors, you know, in the jurisdictions where they're not allowed to take notes, like how that might affect the conversation and the decisions that they come to make when they are in the jury room, you know, hashing things out?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a lot of thoughts on it, that it should be allowed. I've never understood why you couldn't do that. I mean, for me, half the stuff that I hear, if I didn't have it recorded or if I hadn't been taking notes, I would misremember it, period. But especially when you're talking about precise timelines and things where, you know, it really matters what was said specifically. I just don't understand why that's not allowed.
Yeah, I served on a criminal trial, as I mentioned on the show, and there was only a half day trial. We deliberated over lunch. It was wonderful because we were all sort of on the same page. But it became very clear very quickly, because we weren't allowed to take notes, that if one person in there, you know, had claimed to have a very strong memory of something happening, or that somebody said something that was different than what they actually said, it's pretty easy to imagine how someone's interpretation or memory or misinterpretation or mismemory of something that a witness said could influence the group. If the person says, what I'm positive I heard 7 hours ago or whatever was X, Y, or Z, you could imagine being adjourned, being like, oh, I must have missed that. Like, it's easy to imagine, right?
Well, plus when the lawyers are talking, no offense to the lawyers on the call, but I literally remember falling asleep during a trial once that I was covering, and I snorted myself awake, and the reporter next to me laughed his ass off because some of this stuff is just really, really mundane and boring. So when somebody says, oh, I definitely remember that, of course you're going to believe them, and there's a decent chance that you don't remember that.
Well, Colin, the jury in this case deliberated about 5 hours. Is that long? Is that short? Like, what does that length of time tell you about the jury here? Does it say anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, it says that a consensus formed pretty quickly, and, you know, it's possible there were a couple outliers who were pretty quickly convinced, but 5 hours likely means there was some discussion and there wasn't much in the way of dissenting voices, and relatively rapidly they had this decision. So certainly I would say that it's not something where there were jurors in the case who are really holding out, probably moved pretty swiftly.
We should also probably, there was probably a meal.
True.
there too. Like, that's a thing. They sometimes feed you, you know, dinner or whatever, lunch, and, you know, some people don't like to talk while they're eating and some do. So yeah, it is not a huge amount of time. What do you think, Robbie? Do you think that consensus was reached quickly? Do you think that, you know, I know that when I was on a jury, we decided to stay in the room a little bit longer because we felt like, you know, we'd come to a not guilty verdict. We all agreed. I actually took a poll as we sat down to eat sandwiches and everyone was already there. So we were like, are we done? And then we were like, should we just hang out in here a little longer? So it seems like we're doing something more. Like, there was that weird part of the conversation too. So what do you think of this 5 hour timeline?
Yeah, you know, it's slightly longer than it took for the jury to convict Anand, which was like this 3 hours. I always think it's a little bit hairy to have a jury start deliberating on a Friday, and certainly a Saturday too. I think there's, I mean, we're all human beings. I mean, I think there's like this kind of desire to just want to go home as well after like days and days of this kind of stuff. So I don't know if there's any studies done on that, but I do wonder, I feel like juries, it just seems like juries that start deliberating like on a Friday or I guess a weekend like this, probably just wrap up faster because they just want to go home.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, to me, given, I mean, look at how complicated, I mean, like you edit the case and it's still hard to keep so much, like track of so much. To me, it just seems like either they felt overwhelmingly convinced of the guilt, it was just so clear to them, or they were just fatigued and just didn't like wanted to go home, or they just didn't deliberate carefully. They really didn't give a case with this much information the consideration it deserved.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Couple quick listener questions, and then I'd like to open up the floor before we wrap up. So Bonnie Thomas asks, according to Hayes' testimony, an unknown party and the TBI removed a section of wall and that the sawdust was fresh and matched. So where is that sawdust? If you look closely at the photos, there is no sawdust, no marks on the ground from sawdust being removed, and no sawdust. Also, if they removed the sawdust, how was the bullet still found lying on the ground? How would they have removed every speck of sawdust without disturbing the bullet? So I ask again, where is the magical sawdust? Rabia, thoughts?
Yeah, I looked at those pictures a lot. I mean, like, it's kind of dirt. I mean, there's dirt in the, like, you know, the shed is built on, like, you know, like, just open land, and it's there's dirt. So I looked at it a number of times thinking myself, should I be able to see the sawdust? Maybe I don't know enough about sawdust to know that I shouldn't be. I just thought maybe it's mixed in the dirt. Certainly you can't see any of it. But also, you know, we're not talking about a major woodworking operation here. I mean, how much sawdust could really be created from just cutting out like one little
section.
I'd
be surprised.
But the weird thing to me is this.
Right, Amber?
Like... Yeah, we're doing home projects.
Amber's been doing a lot of sawing lately. I know she would know the answer to this. You saw a little tiny bit, and you get a tremendous amount of sawdust. It's actually a thing.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, you don't see any in the picture. I also think it's interesting because you have the state arguing. I mean, like, you know, the agent Krawczyk himself testified about the sawdust and Greg cutting it out specifically, cutting out that portion of the shed specifically to burn. But then you've got these other witnesses who are like, oh, he's burning dresser drawers, which is like a whole different thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Why? And also, why is he burning dresser drawers? Like, what dresser is he? What's going on?
I don't know.
Anyway, he also, by the way, has his own giant piece of property where he could burn anything he wants. Like, why would he go somewhere else to burn stuff? Anyway, I digress. Lisa wants to know, besides the obvious irresponsibility of Greg's defense attorneys to not even read / question the forensic evidence, has Greg been able to pursue anything legally regarding his attorneys for such devastating oversights?
I mean, he can't really like go after them personally. I mean, like he has raised ineffective assistance claims in subsequent legal actions, and we're going to be talking in the final episode about everything that happened since procedurally.
All right. Well, Amber, do you have any final questions for the panel before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I do. So the woman who was at the motel that he spent some hours with, there's very
Debbie.
Yeah.
Debbie.
That's Debbie,
right.
Not Debbie.
Debbie, not Debbie. That's right. I was curious, has they already talked to her? They can't claim that as new evidence, right? So they didn't present her at trial, but they wouldn't be able to come back and say
right.
Okay. I was curious about that.
Yeah, it's not new evidence. I mean, they had that evidence the whole time.
But they chose not to put her on, which is it's a questionable choice. But because they talked to her, it's counterproductive that they even tracked her down.
It was just one of those like really unfortunate things for Greg. I mean, although I would say, look, let's say she actually had her timings right and they presented her as an alibi. It still kind of makes him look bad. And I don't know how much the jury would have liked her because of her circumstances, the fact she's an unmarried woman who's having a baby and she had a one night stand with this guy. You know, I don't know if she would have won the jury over anyway, so even if she had her timings right. But the sad thing is, you know, she was an important witness for what he was up to that night. But just because she got that one thing wrong, I do think, though, I was happy to see that it's not like anybody tried to convince her to change her story. And I think that's unlike what we'll see, like, with the state.
Sure. I sometimes forget that juries are... they're not as good at compartmentalizing as I probably am. I don't care what he did that night unless he killed the two people. Like that's right. It doesn't matter what he was doing beyond that.
Right. But, you know, I mean, like, so in the Joey Watkins season, I mean, like, you know, the fact that he might have shot a dog had such an impact on the jury. Jurors do care about this stuff.
Yeah, they do. They do unless they don't. You know, I know I've talked about it twice already. The case that I was a juror on this year, there was a lot of weird stuff going on with the witnesses, but it didn't matter because the state's case was terrible. And like everybody, it was very affirming, very life affirming to be with a room in a room of 11 other people, all from different backgrounds, never met them before, all different ages, all from different parts of the state. And we all immediately were like, oh, yeah, we don't care that this family is chaotic and that these people seem to be really troubled. And we don't care.
That's great.
It doesn't seems clear she didn't do it. It is possible, but I can see that it could get a different group of 12 people and you've got a different outcome, right? Yeah. So, Amber Hunt, I have a question for you before we wrap up. You teased this week a new season of Accused, one of my all-time favorite podcasts,
so
coming out in December. Can you tell us anything about what you're working on? Please, anything.
We're still a little guarded about it, but I'll say the case involves a guy who went to work in a highly guarded facility and somehow died there, and the death was investigated as a suicide. So we have been looking at it for more than a year, and we lay out why we think it at least should have been considered a possibility that homicide was involved.
Hmm. All right. Well, I can't wait to hear that. I honestly cannot recommend Accused enough. It's one of my all-time favorite true crime podcasts. I'm a huge admirer of your work, Amber, and I'm so thrilled you were able to join us for this week's addendum. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I always love it.
And Rabia and Colin, I'm so thrilled that we were able to talk about episode 8 with both of you. I will admit, I cannot wait to get my hands on all of your tape for episode 9 so I can hear about the dismantling. It's always my favorite part of every season, the dismantling. So thank you guys very much. This has been really fun talking to you this week.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lantz series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod, and you can ask questions for future addendum episodes on Twitter or Facebook. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum. Remember, the sponsors of Undisclosed make it possible for this team to continue doing their great work. So please support all the sponsors you hear about on this show and buy their products. Our executive producer is the great Methil Telhan. Audio production for the addendum is done by the wonderful Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song is by Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. And of course, this whole thing would not be possible without the incredible organizational skills and work and diligence of the amazing executive producer, Methil Telhan. Special thanks to Kevin Flynn, my partner in crime and life, for picking up some of my work so I could host this series. Thanks to Rabia, Susan, and Colin, who continue making Undisclosed a fulfilling and fun part of my podcasting life. And on behalf of everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week. All you have to do is plagiarize and you can make $1 million on your page.
Right?
Or just so get easy. Kim Kardashian to listen and share to
exactly.
her followers.
Exactly.
Good
I'd
God.
Prefer the Kim Kardashian share over the plagiarizing myself.
Plagiarizing.
Well, I'll take any of that Kardashian. I will take it. Like if Kim Kardashian says anything about my podcast, I will take it with no complaints.
Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com. If you run a Shopify store, listen up. Shopify's got you covered for selling, but when your shipping volume grows and you're juggling multiple plugins just to get orders out the door, you need tools that can keep up. Stop duct taping your shipping workflow and use the tools that work better together, like Shopify and ShipStation. Think of ShipStation as Shopify's dedicated shipping partner. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels to save you time and money by automating the entire order fulfillment process, from syncing your orders all the way through inventory management and returns. Automate the rate browser to select the lowest rates on shipments, with discounts up to 90% off major carriers like USPS, UPS, and FedEx. No wonder businesses that use ShipStation grow 3 times faster on average and ship 15 times more orders. See how ShipStation can help you scale and boost your Shopify sales. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com. Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com. Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com. Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
Quick, choose a meal deal with McValue. The $5 McChicken meal deal, the $5 McDouble meal deal, or the new $6 Daily Double meal deal. Each with its own small fries, drink, and four-piece McNuggets. It's actually no rush. I'm just excited for McDonald's.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Not valid for McDelivery.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.